friends. As the first speaker pointed out, the subject of our lecture today is Shiva, the Yogi of Yogis. Mahashivratri falls on the 13th day in the dark fortnight in the month of Magha or Maha. It is called Vigil Night of Shiva, which means we are supposed to remain awake, vigilant, aware, but of which people have only grasped that you are supposed to remain awake. Jagran Karvan. So, at least in the earlier days, people used to stay awake by listening to kathas, they would sing devotional songs, they would read scriptures, but slowly and gradually it got so deteriorated that somehow or the other you should stay awake so people will watch movie after movie or they will be playing cards and so on. We see that it is of great significance. Vigil Night of Shiva. It is in fact directly connected with what in the Western nations it is called Dark Night of the Soul. This is having a direct reference to the life of a chela or a disciple, where he has reached such a stage now that he is called for observing and becoming aware of dark side of his own nature. We know that we have dark side to our nature. We are aware that we are sometimes prone to anger, maybe we have greed for money, maybe we are jealous. These are obvious gross weaknesses and faults, and we can see them. But as we conquer them, as Light on the Path says, that the vices of men, they undergo transformation and reappear with subtle aspect in the heart of a chela. So these are going to be not the gross anger and the gross greed, but in a very subtle way, these weaknesses are still within you. And how do you become aware? Only through becoming vigilant, awake, aware, and through a kind of self-examination is what the Vigil Night of Shiva is reminding us. In fact, it is not the self-examination only on the day of Shivratri, but that self-examination must happen daily, as Theosophy says, either first thing in the morning or before going to sleep, last thing in the day. Go over your thoughts, go over what kind of feelings you entertain, what actions you perform. And in other words, why not remain vigilant and awake and aware of what you do and what you speak from minute to minute? This is the whole message. But as we see, we are more given over to the external than to the internal. The whole spiritual life is understood as something which is a mere external observance. And therefore you have even stories somehow which people like to hear and imitate. And with Shivratri, we are all aware of the story of a man who was lost in the jungle somewhere and he couldn't find his way out, so he climbs up the tree and he is waiting for the day to come. While he is sitting on the tree, he has nothing better to do, so he is plucking the leaves and throwing them down. Accidentally, the tree happens to be the bell tree as it were, which has what is called as leaves, which we know as bilav patra. And he is just picking them and throwing down. And accidentally it happens that there is a shivling also beneath the tree. So exactly leaves are falling on the shivling. Inadvertently, accidentally, unknowingly, he has offered the bilav patra on the shivling, something which you are supposed to do in the puja and so on. And therefore, of course, Shiva is pleased and he appears before him. It is giving a message that even accidental observance of certain ceremony is going to bring you great reward. This is what we want. There is no devotion required. There is no faith required. All that is required is just putting the bilav patra on the shivling, just like you say about prayers. That prayers without devotion do not reach the God. You see, if it was so simple, mechanically you can engage some parrots to do the reciting of the prayers and it will bring the results, but it is not so. The whole element of devotion and faith is missing here. But that is what somehow we seem to be doing, not exactly as mechanically as that man, but pretty mechanically we are observing festivals and thinking that we are earning punya or we have become spiritual or at least religious and pious. Now Shiva, of course, is part of the trinity of Brahma, Vishnu, Shiva. We consider them as three aspects of one reality, Paramatma, Parabrahma, connected with creation, preservation, destruction and regeneration. Shiva is concerned with destruction and regeneration. But all gods have various aspects. So also Shiva. Looking at that very Shivlinga, you get the idea that there is that other higher aspect of Shiva conveyed by the symbol of the Shivling. You have various kinds of Shivlings. You have a Shivling which is sometimes Swayambhu, self-existent, on its own it has come up. You have Sphatik Shivling. Sphatik Shivling is normally colorless. Both of these are representative of self-existent Nirguna Brahmam. So, in one sense, that Shivling is representative of the Nirguna Parabrahmam without attributes, the highest deity, the Paramatma. There is one more kind of Shivling in Linga Purana. It is called Agni Bhu. This Agni Bhu is the fiery phallus, fiery male generative organ, and is also representative of the very Parabrahma, because it is said that it is Shiva Linga. The Linga is the word which comes from Laya and Agamana. Laya is dissolution and Agamana is Manvantara or manifestation. So this is the source from which everything comes out, to which everything comes back again. It is that very Parabrahma, container of all things, and from which everything once again emerges cyclically, the worlds, the human beings, and so on and so forth. So you can see another aspect of Shiva. This very beautifully portrayed in a story where you have Brahma, Vishnu, Shiva, of which Brahma and Vishnu are fighting as to who is the greater or the greatest of all. And we are told that suddenly there is a kind of infinite pillar of light. They don't know it is infinite, but it's a pillar of light which appears before them. And that is supposed to be Shiva in the form of the pillar of light. And he tells them, find out the beginning and or find out the end of this pillar. Whoever is able to do that, he will be the greatest. So Brahma with his Vahan, Hamsa or Kala Hamsa, flies above, tries to go to the top. And Vishnu with his Vahan, Boar, Varaha, tries to go down and find the bottom of that pillar of light. They just go on and on and on. It is an infinite pillar of light. This in a way shows again the infinite, boundless, unchanging Parabrahmam, Paramatma, the highest aspect. So Shiva is two aspects. One is a very Parabrahmam. That you will find in many gods. Even if you take Vishnu, it's mind-boggling the way he is a preserver, but he is also in a much higher aspect than that. And so also Shiva. And we do find that Shiva, when most of the temples, they have Shivlinga, it is with the yoni. So it is lingam and yoni. And there again, there is a different aspect. The lingam is the male generative organ. The yoni, female generative principle, and therefore this is Purusha and Prakriti, spirit and matter, through which only the manifestation can take place. Now, many mythological stories are there about Shiva, and the first one we would want to tell about is Shiva, having wedded to Uma, Parvati, whatever name you talk call. He is having, therefore, his father-in-law as Daksha or Daksha Prajapati. This Daksha Prajapati is having a yagna or sacrifice. And we are told that he has not invited Shiva, but Uma is very anxious to be present there. So she goes there, but she is insulted by her father. So she then gives up her body into that fire of the sacrifice and burns herself to death. Shiva comes to know about this, so he creates a demon, thousand-armed, thousand-headed Virabhadra, to destroy Daksha Prajapati's sacrifice. It is destroyed. Now what is all this? Is this some family quarrel going on between son-in-law and the father-in-law? No. It is something which is to do with the whole process of evolution. We are told that Daksha Prajapati is concerned with physiological and biological evolution. And therefore directly is considered to be concerned with the evolution of the physical form of man. And we can take one meaning of this destroying his sacrifice as students of theosophy knowing how the human body as we see it today was not always like this. We are told it has occupied millions of years perhaps to get a body like this. Once upon a time man was globular in shape. Then there was time when man was having a gigantic ape-like form. He had several different kinds of astral, ethereal forms. One by one, they were discarded. Till finally, a form like this was there. Now, those forms which were discarded. It's like destroying in order so that you can have a new form. So there is a destruction and regeneration. And wherever there is destruction and regeneration, Shiva is there. So Shiva destroying the sacrifice of Daksha Prajapati means he is involved in the process of evolving better and better bodies till you have a perfect human form as we find it today. Another meaning is that Shiva is presiding over intellectual evolution. And Theosophy says there is a triple line of evolution: physical evolution, intellectual evolution, and spiritual evolution. So, Shiva, by destroying the sacrifice, wants to show that evolution cannot proceed along only physical lines. There is also the other two parts or aspects. And then, in one sense, isn't there destruction and regeneration going on from moment to moment? We find, as science says, atoms are going constantly from your body, replaced by new atoms. In 7 years' time, all the atoms are replaced with the new atoms. So in 7 years' time, you have a brand new body, which we are not even aware of. So this is destruction regeneration, which goes on at the level of ideas, thoughts, feelings, desires. How many times we would have changed our ideas, our desires, feelings. It's a constant renovation, as it were, of the inner man, of the inner being. Now, this is what the first quotation is pointing out. Shiva, the destroying deity, evolution and progress personified, who is the regenerator at the same time, who destroys things under one form, but to recall them to life under another, more perfect type. So, this is what keeps happening. Renovation, a better and a better form, and a better and a better and a higher progress. So, connected with intellectual evolution, where is Shiva? We know as students of theosophy that there was that point in the time of our evolution when man was man only in form. Precisely the form we are talking about. The perfect physical form with perfect brain. Brain of much better and deeper capacity than that of any other animal. That is the point at which now man was ready for something, and that is for activation of his mind, which we call as the lighting up of manas. Man's mind was there, but it was latent. This had to be lighted up and activated. Who did that? That was done by what we call as Kumaras, Manasaputras, Agnishwata Pitris, solar deities, so many names are there. So, these Kumaras are the sons of Shiva. We know names of two Kumaras at least. One is Ganpati, the other is Kartikeya. These are both Kumaras who are very much or who were very much engaged in this process of the lighting up of Manas. So is Shiva. Either he is called the father of Kumaras or he is called the chief of Kumaras. But in short, all of them were engaged in lighting up the mind. And as HPB says, like you have one lighted candle, one lighted lamp with which you will be able to light up so many unlighted lamps or candles, that's exactly how our minds which were lying latent were lighted up, activated, and what happened? We got the power to think, power to choose, and also self-consciousness. But choices, how can you make right choice unless you have knowledge? So we are told that all these Kumaras, Shiva included, were engaged also in giving to that human race what is known as knowledge of arts, science, architecture, sculpture, and also spiritual ideas. HPB tells us that science is at error when they are saying the Paleolithic man, the Neolithic man who lived in caves, who hardly knew how to light up fire, suddenly after a few thousand years, he comes to the stage of being so civilized. Those grand monuments like the building of the pyramids, the building of temples, agriculture, quantum leap, it is not possible. Unless and until you admit of this lighting up of Manas, where he gets the power and he gets the knowledge. Only then it is possible. So this is a very important aspect in human evolution. Man would be and man was no better than an animal, but for the Kumaras and Manasaputras. Now man is at a stage where, as HPB says, he can raise himself and become higher than the gods. One hierarchy of gods or even combination of hierarchy of gods, because he can choose the right, he can choose something which is divine and spiritual. What a tremendous gift to mankind has been given by Shiva and the Kumaras is what we must appreciate. And that's why no wonder we are told that the Kumaras and Shiva, they are not interested in any kind of emotional satisfaction, nor are they interested in any satisfying of worldly desires. What they are interested in is to make animal man a human man and a human man into divine man. And that is the reason why Shiva is called Bholenath, a simpleton. Why he is Bholenath? Sometimes people who don't know enough of what we call as Dunyadari, it's a very algari kind of a person, we say, Bichara Bhola hai. Doesn't understand the nitty-gritty and the intricacies of this worldly life. He is like that. It's not as if he doesn't understand. He doesn't care about the worldly existence in one sense, the way in which we have got involved in the worldly life. He is not involved in worldly life. He's quite detached from there. And in that sense, he's Bholenath. Not because, as we understand, that he's very Bhola. Of all the gods, you must pray to Shiva, worship him. Little worship and he is going to be pleased. He is the god who is easily pleased. Far from that. He has nothing to do with giving the boons and vardhan of the worldly kind. I want this and I want that. He is far above that. And in a way, there is a double atmosphere about Shiva. On the one hand, he is Shiva Rudra, the terrible destroyer of the passions and desires which are only of selfish, self-centered and the worldly kinds. And on the other hand, he is Shiva. Shiva means auspicious. He is that auspicious power in the universe which is all the time in support of people who are genuinely seeking spiritual life. There is always the invisible support for all who are trying to live the spiritual life. And what more? He is Pashupati. Pashupati is a shepherd. He is the leader of the flock. Interestingly, our Krishna is a gwala, a cowherd. Interestingly, Jesus is a shepherd, and so is Shiva a shepherd. What is this about shepherd so much? Shepherd actually, we know, takes the flock of sheep, cow, animal to a place where they can get proper nourishment. But shepherd is also responsible for bringing the flock back to home, seeing that they are not lost on the way. That's the kind of shepherd Shiva is, who is giving us ample nourishment by giving us the right esoteric doctrines and knowledge, and secondly, guiding us on our way back to the spiritual home. As HPB says, humanity is an emanation from divinity on its return path thereto. But the return path is not so simple. The return path can go into bylanes. Return path, you are going to be enamored of many things. And that's why we are told, here, pause and see what is said about Shiva in the secret doctrine. Two things are said. One, this Shiva is, it's a symbol, which if you can try to visualize, is a symbol of ever-living human banyan tree. The banyan tree is majestic, with so many branches and offshoots, very majestic tree. And it is ever-living tree. It doesn't really wilt or doesn't really wither. This is the ever-living human banyan tree, which is Shiva. And what are these branches and offshoots and leaves? They are the rishis, they are the sages, they are the divine instructors and teachers of humanity. In that sense, Shiva is Mahaguru. Under his guidance, the teachers come to humanity at many, many different times in their evolution to guide them, to give them knowledge which we tend to make obscure time and again. Another aspect of Shiva, almost as a human being, is that aspect which is called the great sacrifice. This is the Shiva who remains in the atmosphere of the earth. This is the Shiva, therefore, who has nothing to learn, who has nothing to achieve, and yet he chooses to remain in touch with misery of humanity. And as HPB, we will not read that long quotation, but do read it. Those are very moving words and we cannot duplicate them. Where she says, we who are traveling in this limitless desert of illusion called earth life are never too sure of not losing our path. There he is sitting to guide us and show the right path so that this lonely, sore-footed pilgrim can reach safely his spiritual home. It's a very lovely description given of the pilgrimage we are all supposed to be on, whether we realize it or not. What happens in a desert? In the desert, you have mirage, what we call janjwana jal. You feel it is water, and how? Animals and humans, they will run in that direction to find, no, it was only an illusion. So also, are we not running around to find final, permanent happiness? Something which will never be taken away from us, but we are going from one thing to another, from one pleasure to another, and it always eludes us. So, in this search for pleasure and final happiness, we meet with lot of illusory things. And sometimes it is an illusion of the kind of glamour. Glamour of psychic powers, glamour of a little progress, and we are going on a different path. To bring us back, there is Shiva. So there is this being who is there to guide us wherever we are receptive to the guidance from this being. Now, we do see, therefore, that this is the aspect of Shiva where it is at a very high level. Coming back to the allegory which we saw of Shiva losing Uma, and one of the mythologies says that after losing his wife, he has become insensible to love. He has lost all emotions. He is sitting always in the contemplation. Gods are very afraid what has happened to him, what is going to happen. So they approach Kama, who is a god of love. And he is asked, do something. Somehow you kindle this love in his heart. And Kama, the god of love, we are told, he aims his arrow at Shiva where he is sitting in contemplation. Shiva feels the stirring of desire. And he sees that this cannot be on its own. There is something. So he opens his eyes and there he sees Kama with his bow and arrow, with an arrow pointed at him. So Shiva is angry. That's how mythology will put it. He opens his third eye and burns Kama to ashes. This is literally taken. There is a fire coming. He is angry. And so I think in Gujarati we say, Maru triju netra kholis ne, to khabar padse. So triju netra is like you are angry and you are going to destroy. That's not the meaning of the third eye. Third eye is not just the anger of Shiva. It's something more and much higher than just the anger. The third eye is supposed to be, in a way, the spiritual eye, the spiritual will, and it is something which transforms, in a way. He is reduced to ashes. And we are told that then wife of Kama pleads with Shiva to bring him back to life. He is brought back to life, but Shiva is a destroyer and a regenerator. So he is not brought back in the same form. He is brought back as Ananga, Ananga, that means formless. So, that Kama, which was only a human desire and concerned with human love, is now transformed and he has become Ananga, the formless. Passion is transformed into compassion. This is what we find is done by using the third eye. Now, what is this third eye? In the secret doctrine, HPB says that the third eye of Shiva is the opened eye of Dangma. Dangma is a purified soul. Dangma is an initiate. Dangma is a Mahatma. Dangma is therefore a spiritually regenerated wise man who has a kind of spiritual eye. With this spiritual eye, he can see past, present and future, what we call as a Trikala Gnani. With this spiritual eye, he has spiritual intuition. With this spiritual eye, he has a direct perception. This is the highest aspect of the third eye of Shiva. What does HPB say? She says that, as Shankaracharya said, that Brahma Satya Jagat Mithya. This world is an illusion. Because, really speaking, there's so many things which you see in the world have no existence. Really speaking, it is all the work of Maya. It is Maya or illusion which makes you see, instead of that one divine essence, multiplicity of things. And this multiplicity of things, we can't help but see because we are not able to penetrate Maya. Then who can penetrate Maya? And to that she says, only when a great evolved soul, when he directs his eye of Dangma, which is the third eye of Shiva, he is able to look beneath the veil of Maya and see the divine essence. He is the man, therefore, who is able to see not separate existence, but oneness, unity, the same divine present in the heart of all beings. So, this is the third eye of Shiva. At a lower level, we call it as an intuition which helps poets and writers to create the work of art, maybe poetry, maybe good novel and so on. It is this intuition which makes us aware of what the other person wants, what's going on in his mind, without using the rational mind, without really reasoning from premises to conclusion. It is a direct perception in any field that you may be. This is the third eye in its highest aspect. It is that which makes you see the very divine. Now, coming back therefore, it is that spiritual will, which is also connected with the third eye, which helps you to transform passion into compassion. Passion cares only for pleasure and happiness of me, my family and my loved ones. Compassion is worried about happiness of all that lives and breathes. Passion is a love which is therefore only and only limited to few people. And this love, HPB says, is a barrier. It's an obstacle to occultism and spiritual life. As she says, what mother will not really not care about other children in order that her own child gets what he wants and to see him happy? What husband will not make other women unhappy in order to see smile on the face of the woman he loves? If in your heart there is love for only select few people, what place there can be for the whole of humanity? So, compassion is the universal love for all that lives and breathes, and that cannot be if there is passion. So, these are two aspects. One is kama, the other is kama deva. One is kama, which is desire at the level of procreation, man and woman procreating and bringing children. The other is kamadeva, a divine desire at a very high level, which is existing in the very bosom of the Parabrahmam or one reality. So, in the Western philosophy, kama is Cupid, and you keep seeing him everywhere on Valentine's Day, where that little angelic boy is having bow and arrow. With the arrow he is piercing the heart, just the human love. And there is the Eros. It is a pure divine desire. It is the primal germ in the mind. It is that desire which brings about the stirring within the Parabrahm. As HPB says, he sets fire to the absolute. When the universe has to come into existence, the first beginnings are made by Kamadeva, Eros. It is also that compassion. What compassion? Not ordinary love. It is that divine love. It is that love which is only wishing for progress and further progress of all that lives and breathes. All the creatures, may they progress and go ahead. And if in the process, if they suffer, it is perfectly all right. This is not acceptable to us. This compassion is not love to us. We only know love which pampers. This is a very noble, exalted love which cares for progress, and in the process, pain is going to accompany that progress. As HPB says, that you cannot have progress unless and until there is proportionate pain also. So, there are these words which are from the secret doctrine. Kama is the first conscious, all-embracing desire for universal good. Love for all that lives and feels, needs help and kindness. The first feeling of infinite tender compassion and mercy that arose in the consciousness of the creative one force as soon as it came into life and being, as a ray from the absolute, the Parabrahmam. This is Kamadeva. So all in all, we are able to appreciate, as HPB, we will not read that long quotation, that Shiva therefore is like a good gardener. Very apt analogy. The gardener will see to it that all the weeds, all the useless plants are plucked away, rooted out, so that they will not obstruct the growing of those useful plants. And she is using the metaphor that Shiva, like a good gardener, is rooting out the plants, cosmic and human alike. The worlds come into existence and they go out of existence when they have run their course. Human beings come into existence and go out of existence when the body has served its purpose, in order that new world can be born and a new body can be taken and a new personality can be taken. So on and on and on, destruction and regeneration from the lowest to the highest level is the work of Shiva, because without pain, destruction, there cannot be growth and renewal. Now, yoga and Shiva, the yogi of yogis, he's concerned with yoga. Our reading said a lot about yoga. One meaning of yoga comes from the yuj, meaning to unite. Uniting with your own divine nature is yoga. And this yoga, or union with the divine, unfortunately is not understood as the Raja Yoga, which is enshrined in the Bhagavad Gita, but more like the Hatha Yoga. Because that's the thing, in one sense, which is easier, at least to begin with. Not easy to carry out. Hatha Yoga is very difficult, really, to bring to its conclusion, but easy in a way to begin. Standing on one leg for years together, raising your one hand, staring at the sun for hours on end, go without food and water. Is this really the yoga? Our reading began by saying that this divine discipline called yoga is not to be attained by one who sleeps too much or too little, eats too much or too little. So, the middle path. In recreation, in eating, in sleeping, the moderation is all that is required. We are not going to pay undue attention to how many upvas I have done and so on. That we must first grasp. Nor is Shiva interested in your wealth. Going and offering a lot of wealth to Shiva is not going to please him. Nor is he interested in beauty, for that matter, as the stories of Uma, Parvati, all decked up, dressed up, beautiful looking, serving Shiva, and he is indifferent to her. Only when she smears her body with ashes, wears simple clothes, it is then she is succeeding in drawing the attention of Shiva. What is this? Shiva himself is called the dweller of Ghat. Which Ghat? Smashan Ghat. He is supposed to be sitting in the Smashana. What a place to be chosen by a god to sit in the Smashana. His own body is smeared with ashes. What is this ashes all the time which you smear your body with? Well, in Smashana what you do is burn your physical body, which has decayed, which is really of no use now. But we are not asked to do some self-immolation. Both Parvati and Shiva smearing their body with ashes means you have to therefore burn, destroy, or rather overcome your personal self. That personal self or personality must be burnt, must be overcome. Only then you are worthy of drawing attention of Shiva. No amount of going on Mondays to Shiva temple, no amount of fasting on Shivratri is going to really draw you a whit nearer to Shiva in a higher spiritual sense. It is only and only when you are able to subdue the personality, subdue your passions and desires, subdue the personal animal man, like he as a Pashupati is able to do, we also should be able to tame the animal within. And what he is saying by smearing his body with the ashes is a kind of supreme detachment is something which you cultivate. Other teachers have said the same thing without mincing words sometimes. As Vadiyaji at one place says, these rather harsh words coming from Jesus, who says, he who loves his father and mother more than me is not worthy of becoming my disciple. Now, is he saying that therefore you be indifferent to your father and mother? No. He is simply saying you can't serve two masters. If your attachment is there still with the family members, with the father and mother and all that, you can't give the wholehearted submission to the divine discipline. And then you have Kabir saying, Kabira khada bazaar mein liye lukati haath, jo ghar bare apna chalde mere saath. What a tremendous thing he is asking. I am standing in the marketplace carrying a burning torch in my hand. And anyone who can take the torch and burn his house can follow me. He is worthy of being my follower. Now what is this burning the house? What is this not looking at the father and mother? It's absolutely detached attachment, which is what we are told by HPB, by Maulankar in this pamphlet on contemplation. To be in the world, but not be of the world. See, Shiva also, he is called reluctant householder. He has married, he has a wife, but on the other hand, he keeps running to the wilderness and there he is contemplating and all that. By the way, that also brings to our mind that whole symbology which is existing of the Datura plant, which is supposed to be in a way offered to Shiva, the drinking of the bhang. Some writer has nicely interpreted Datura, then cannabis from which bhang is made, and a third thing is there. These are, yes, the todi palm, which is supposed to be consecrated to Balram. All these gods, they are hermits. They would prefer to remain in the wilderness, in places where there is no one, sit and meditate. So these plants are also growing more in the wilderness, in the wilder places, rather than amongst the civilization. And then, of course, you are shown people drinking bhang, getting intoxicated, the gross misunderstanding of the symbol, as happens in all religion. Jesus is supposed to have given bread and wine to his disciples. Baptism, the person is given bread and wine. Are we asked to drink wine? Is Shiva saying you drink bhang? Are the Sufis saying you get intoxicated when one of them is seen with surahi of wine in his hands, one of the Sufi saints? Intoxication is ecstasy. And we are told that that ecstasy used to be achieved sometimes with the help of soma juice. Now many of them want to pass off bhang as soma juice. And the Vedas and the Vedant will say, nothing doing. Your bhang is not soma juice. Soma juice itself is an allegory, itself is a symbol of soma, the moon, so that the moon concerned with the astral body, when you are able to purify your astral, your soul with the purified astral will rise to the higher regions and you can really get the highest knowledge. Who understands all this? This is yoga. This is divine discipline. And yes, he is Kala Bhairav. Kala is time and Bhairav is something which makes you Biru. Are we not Biru, afraid of time, which snatches away from us things and people which are dear to us? Who knows what will be taken away from us next moment? So in that sense, he is a Kala Bhairav, presiding over time. As Krishna says, I am time matured, come for the destruction of these creatures. And so also, we therefore in the individual lives have to look for this transformation, which is Shiva's work, which we do. If we think in the heart of hearts is Shiva residing. And therefore we are told that just like the pupa, the insect, from its saliva it builds the cocoon, which we call cocheto. And after a few days or a month, it will break the cocoon and come out as a completely transformed, beautiful butterfly. That ugly creature has built the cocoon and now he breaks it with his own might and comes out as a transformed, beautiful butterfly. So is the personality. We are built with our likes and dislikes, these ideas, those desires. We have to break. They are like plaster of Paris molds. When you are making idol, the mold is not proper. You break one mold, you prepare another mold and another mold till you have a perfect idol. That's exactly what we are in the process of doing. And that's what in letters that have helped me we are told. That this is the process. This is the procedure in a way which every chela, every disciple has to undertake. Every few months, every few days, he has to look back and take stock. What am I now? What was I few months back? Is there any change? What weaknesses I have mastered? What virtues I have garnered? What desires have I conquered? Am I a different person? As a senior student used to say, I used to be a firebrand in my office. And you feel, and he must be feeling, now I am a much more subdued, calm, forgiving person. Are we finding this change? Are we able to say that? That person has died. This is a new person. That ought to happen. As I think in those very words, letters that have helped me, we are told that every few months, new self rises before you. Let that happen more frequently. A new improved you, like you have a new improved version of biscuits and washing machines, let the new improved you also be there, because that's what is really celebrating Shivratri. And of course, lastly, we will see the three dances of Shiva. The three dances are also very deep. First is the cosmic dance, where he is playing his damru, which changes chaos into cosmos. Chaos is matter which is quiescent, passive. It has to be activated. So, the damru sound is activating the matter. It may be therefore compared to what we call as Shabda Brahmam, Nada Brahmam. It is the divine resonance and vibrations which actually stirs up and brings into motion the particles of matter, which then work based on the vibrations imparted to them, and the world, the universe, comes into existence. The other dance is Tandav, the dance of destruction. It is supposed to be done by him in Smashana, showing the destruction of the dead and the decaying body. But that same Tandav must take place within us, with our own permission and vigilance. And the third is the dance which is called the Nataraj dance. So many times we buy that gurti, and there is supposed to be the Nataraj with a fire or a fiery circle all around. And then there are four arms. There is one leg which is raised crosswise. With another leg, he is stamping on a dwarf. One hand is holding damru, creation. Other is holding fire, destruction. Third is holding the sign, making the sign of abhayam. Don't be afraid. Don't run away from the worldly householder's life. Don't run away from the sannyas spiritual life either. Take a balance of the two. And the fourth hand is pointing the finger downward at the leg which is stamping on the dwarf. Now what is the dwarf? The dwarf is the illusion. And therefore pointing out, unless and until you are able to overcome this illusion, there is no liberation or deliverance. So the Nataraja is all in one. Creation, preservation, destruction, regeneration and deliverance as far as a human being is concerned. The time is up. We would want to close with the beautiful words from Master of Wisdom. Absorbed in the absolute self unconsciousness of physical self, plunged in the depths of true being, which is no being but eternal universal life, his whole form as immovable and white as the eternal summits of snow in Kailash, where he sits, above care, above sorrow, above sin and worldliness, a mendicant, a sage, a healer, the king of kings, the yogi of yogis, Such is the ideal Shiva of Yoga Shastras, the culmination of spiritual wisdom. We have written questions, and mostly they are more or less answered. The first one is saying about Lord Shiva seems to be known to India and scriptures of India, full of stories of worship, pouring milk over Shivling and the snake around Shivling. Is there any significance? How would Western world understand them? Yes, we have shown the significance of Shivling also, Shiva also, the worship of Shiva also, what he represents and how he ought to be worshipped really, we showed. And how the Western world would understand them? Western world would understand it only and only if they have the right key. As we are told that unfortunately even in the West, there is something akin to Lingam and Yoni. They also have their angels. They also have their gods. And unfortunately, as HPB says, this is at the highest level Purusha Prakriti, at the lowest level nothing but animal procreation of uniting of male and female. The West can take either of them depending upon where they go and what they understand. Interestingly, looking at this symbology of male and female especially, of Shiva and Shakti also especially, theosophy is saying that there is whole of the Shakta cult. What are they getting by way of symbol? They are also thinking that it is only through union of male and female that you can get to enlightenment and the final liberation. This is a misunderstanding. What is the real understanding? The real understanding of all these pairs of gods and goddesses, Shiva Shakti, Rama Sita, Krishna Radha, what are these pairs doing? They are representative in man of Buddhi and Manas. In the universe of Purusha and Prakriti, we are told there cannot be evolution unless and until there are these two poles of spirit and matter. As so many times in the scriptures, especially in the Sankhya, we are told that Purusha by itself can do nothing. Prakriti is passive and can do nothing unless that Prakriti is stirred and activated by the intelligence of Purusha, which is consciousness. And therefore, the simile they give is the lame man and the blind man. The blind man is Prakriti, the lame man is consciousness of Purusha. They have to go out of the forest. Individually they can't, but the lame man sitting on the shoulder of the blind man can really cross that forest and come out. So also Purusha and Prakriti have to cooperate for the whole process of creation or evolution. That is the whole idea. And in man, unless and until the Buddhi Panas, one of them is the positive and the other is negative. One is Purusha, the other becomes Prakriti. One is active, the other is passive. Till that union happens, there will not be the enlightenment. There will not be the opening of the third eye of Shiva. Because the third eye, the spiritual intuition, is really nothing but Buddhi Manasik conjunction. For that matter, every Mahatma, every sage, every Rishi, every wise person has a permanent conjunction of Buddhi with Manas. You can say that third eye is always open. So this is the thing. And the two other questions also we have taken, as mentioned in many places, Shiva stays on Mount Kailash. Is he watching all the planets from there or only our globe? Mount Kailasha may be a manner of speaking, or Mount Kailasha may actually be the abode of Shiva, because as we said, the great sacrifice, if you look at the thing, the quotation, it is said, as objective man, he is the mysterious yet ever present personage about whom legends are rife in East. So it is an ever present personage. So Shiva is at various levels. He is the very Parabrahma, He is that aspect which is destroying and regenerating agent, but he is also a personage. Perhaps he is in Mount Kailasha, perhaps he is in the atmosphere of the earth, but it is there. And this is nothing to be wondering about, because HPP herself has said that there are gods. They have dual function to perform. They have their own spiritual function to perform on their own plane, and then there is function to be performed on earth. So that is what you can apply. Isn't there a similar thing about the Buddhists? Dhyani Buddha, Bodhisattva, Manushi Buddha. So the same personage on various levels is performing various functions. So yes, there is a being. And it looks that this being is especially connected with the earth chain of globes. Or maybe that being is also connected with evolution on other planets. All that in detail we are not told. But certainly he is connected with evolution of earth chain of planets. The spiritual evolution is all that he is concerned with. He is the keeper of the track of karma and true wisdom also. How is he helping humanity to reach ultimate wisdom? Sacrifice the self to the real self will bring us close to Shiva and his knowledge? Absolutely. That is what we said about ultimately the personality must go. As again Kabir says, Jab main tha, tab hari nahi. Ab hari hai, to main nahi. The self of spirit and the self of matter, two cannot meet. The self of matter is personality. The personal has to be really sacrificed to the divine. Doesn't mean destroy the personality, but tame the personality so that it can become a useful animal for the God within to use. Our time is up.